You're listening to Intellectual Erection,
a place where we talk about the naughty.
To stimulate your thinking.
You're listening
to
Intellectual Erection.
Intellectual Erection.
Передачу, где мы говорим о дискультам,
субъекте
секса.
Мы говорим о
To stimulate your thinking.
Welcome to another episode of Intellectual Erection. I'm your host, Patrick, and today I'm speaking with Mona Lott.
And I'd squirt all over the computer chair and blame it on the cat.
Basically, we talk about Mona's stripping experience, which is significant, and how she would envision her ideal strip club. Don't forget to check out the Insta at intellectual.erection if you are interested in consultation services on sex positivity, which I've been offering. And also go visit my sex positive art page on Instagram at aesthetic.erection. I've got some cool stuff on there. And as always, listen, subscribe, review, and most of all, enjoy. I'm sitting here today with
Mona Lott.
Mona Lott.
Hey guys.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. So good to be here.
So first things first, I want to ask you what it is that you do.
Well, are you speaking to like the current pandemic situation, or is this like an umbrella statement, like what I do normally if we weren't in a global pandemic?
Well, we can tackle both of those things. Okay. What did you do before COVID and what are you doing now?
So pre-COVID, I was dancing in various clubs around Toronto. And I used to really enjoy going and traveling across Canada and doing different like guest spots in different clubs. Yeah, that's what I was doing.
And what have you done since COVID?
Since COVID, I switched my hustle online. So I've started trying with OnlyFans. I was riding out Serb, had a daddy here and there, but it wasn't, they're all trash. They all say they're going to give you the world and then they give you
unsolicited
dick pics and like $6 Amazon outfits in the mail. Like, it's weird. Anyways, yeah.
it's hard to find good sugar daddies, I hear.
Yeah, it really is. So during COVID, yeah, just doing all the online stuff, trying to hustle as hard as that as I possibly can, and piggybacking off of the government funding, which has really, really saved my life.
Well, part of what we're here to talk about today is going to be about how the government here has particularly handled the strip club situation, namely closures and so on. And you have been interviewed several times before about this topic. I believe one was in Vice and the other one was in
Narcity. And then also on Global News. And there were a few other platforms that I was hoping to be interviewed on, but for some reason they decided it would be a great idea to out a sex worker. I don't know. It was super weird. A lot of the publications, other than these ones, like Narcity and Vicity and Vice and Narcity, I'm not dyslexic, are not publications that family members or, you know, too many people that I know from my hometown are going to read. You know, and if they are, then obviously they're tuned in and they're woke and that's fine. Like, read those articles, but I'm not too worried about it, right? These other publications, it was a little concerning using my real name because I really don't want to hurt my family. So that's why, you know, it was just kind of, it's a weird little thing, but well, yeah.
Privacy is very important, especially for sex workers because of, right, the legal gray area. And not totally. Everybody's going to be so understanding in your extended family, even if your, you know, existing kind of so-called nuclear family knows about it. Mm-hmm. So before we get into all of this, the one thing that I ask everybody who comes on the show is the origin question. It's a two-parter, and you can choose to not answer the first part. I'm always just curious, where was the first time in your life as a kid when you encountered the notion of sex or sexuality, like when you became aware that it exists, and if you remember anything around that.
Oh, this is a story.
It's funny how when I ask this, nobody has to pause for too fucking long. It's like it's always there. Like, you know your first sexual memory.
Yeah, we know. I was a really curious kid. I guess I didn't develop early sexually regarding my body, but my brain definitely did, and I knew that certain things made me feel good. Obviously, I grew up in the MSN age, and we had MySpace and all that stuff, and when MSN Messenger and Yahoo Messenger and AOL and all those chat rooms were online, when the internet was really, really unsafe for young girls. I guess that's kind of when I got more tuned into the sexual side of the internet, and I started watching a lot of porn on the family computer.
With dial-up? Like,
yeah, desktop, downstairs, dial-up, yeah, for sure. XXXclips.net. I still remember the site that I frequented.
It still exists.
Does it?
I think so.
Okay. Yeah. That's so funny. So XXXclips.net taught me a lot about foot bondage.
Really?
Yep. And taught me a lot about gangbang squirt porn, and taught me a lot about queer porn, and just kind of all the different styles of porn that there are. And then I kind of graduated from just watching the porn to masturbating while I watched the porn.
So wait, first you were just watching it, you know?
I was just like, what is this? What is happening? I'm 11.
Like, how long was your attention span for porn, first of all, when you were watching it without stimulating yourself?
It was pretty long.
Yeah?
I was like, what are they going to do next? Wow. Like, I was just so intrigued by all of it.
And then did that time frame get shorter and shorter of watching?
Yeah. As soon as I found out that we had a toy that vibrated in the house. Yeah.
The clips got shorter.
Yeah. It was really funny. We had this toy in the house called... It was like this weird fishing toy where it's like Hungry Hungry Hippo, but you had these like paddles that vibrate. The handle would vibrate, and then you pick up the fish and you put them in your pot.
But the handles vibrated.
I was like, cool. So I used that. And I'd squirt all over the computer chair and blame it on the cat.
Wait, did you squirt at like 11 years old?
It might have been pee. I don't know.
I mean.
But whatever I was doing, it felt good. There was a lot of it, so maybe it was half and half. I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, squirt does have a little bit of uric acid in it.
Yeah. But
it's mainly what's called prostatic fluid, from what I've learned in my studies. But yeah, I think it's uncommon usually for it to be just like urine. So
whatever you, it is, you probably it feels were great squirting,
which is really interesting at that age to be like so, you know.
Yeah, like pre-period.
In tune with your body, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it takes people considerable time to get that comfortable. I guess if you're that young, you don't care. You're just like, it's my body. I like it.
Yep. And then it hasn't stopped since. So
you turn on the floodgates.
I'm on board. The dam has been broken.
You know, it's wild how popular squirting has become. I remember growing up, it was this thing that like maybe you heard of happening once. And it was like this myth, like, is it possible? Does it exist? Yeah. And now there's fucking unicorns everywhere. Uh-huh. Now everyone's squirting.
Well, yeah. Which might be. They should.
Right. I mean, it might be a testament to sex positivity. I'm hoping it's a testament to sex positivity that, you know, more people are discovering their bodies. Well, that sounds like you had very early discovery of your body and yourself. And you're still very much in tune with that part of yourself.
Yeah.
So this follows into the second half of the origin question. I ask how you got involved in the sex positive communities. And what I mean by that is like kink, polyamory, BDSM, fetish, sex work. And I'm not sure if you are part of all or some of these communities, but if you are, how did you become involved with some of these communities?
I would say I'm definitely a part of the sex work community, and that's like that's an umbrella term for like strippers, escorts, massage parlor girls, you know, street level sex workers, anyone that does anything with their body, even if it's selling stuff online or
phone operators, not regular phone operators.
You know what I mean? But yeah, yeah. All that type of stuff, I'm definitely involved with. Just based on the fact that that's my social circle as well, right? I tend to keep, if the people in my life aren't really supportive of sex work, then the other people that are in my life are sex workers.
Right.
And that's kind of it. It's either you support the cause or you are a part of it. And there's no one in between.
So how did you become involved with sex work then?
Oh, I got a premature account on Seeking Arrangement when I was very young, and I remember I needed money to go tree planting. Yeah, so I was hustling daddies online for money to get a tent and, like, get my backpack and all my planting gear sorted, which is so fucking funny now that I think about it. Because it didn't even register to me as sex work back then. I was like, I'm going to make this dumb shit on the internet pay for all my things that I need.
Right.
Yeah. That's so funny. Dabbled with that a bunch. Dropped off SA for a while. And then when I was after like a weed trimming stint, actually, in California, I had planted trees that year. Then went and picked fruit. Trimmed some pot. Bunch of shit happened. Ended up in New Orleans after I met some dude on Tinder. This whole big mess. And I was stranded there. I broke up with the dude. I admit that was not the smartest thing I could have done. What? Following the person.
Following him, not
there.
Breaking up with
him. Yeah, like, but it's a whole other story in its own. But I was there. I didn't have much money left from my trim money. And I was kind of forced to make a choice. You know, what kind of job do you want to do? So I tried for every other job because I was kind of done with that type of stuff. I tried getting a job in a restaurant, and I tried getting a job as back of house, front of house, cafes, everywhere. Everyone was asking me for my social because I was an illegal worker down there, right? Like, I wasn't supposed to be working. And no one would hire me. And get this, in New Orleans, the working wage is $2.13 because you make so much money off of tips.
Well, as of what? What year?
It's still the same. I don't think they've raised it.
Oh.
Yeah. I was there in January.
That's fucked up.
$2.13. Like, how rude. Just keep your 13 cents. Like, why do you have, like, what?
$2.13.
That's the math? Oh, man. Yeah, no one would give me a job. It was fucked. So I went and I tried a bunch of strip clubs, and I finally got hired at one, which was nice. Babes on Bourbon, 433 Bourbon, changed my fucking life. And I've never looked back.
In New Orleans?
New Orleans, yeah. New Orleans, Louisiana. It was insane. It's a really good time. I learned a lot. I forget a lot from that time as well. There's still stories that people tell me about shit that I did when I was down there. I'm like, well, I don't know, man.
The bourbon got to you?
They called me Hurricane Maya. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, man.
Well, enjoy your bourbon. We're yep. Sipping some bourbon right now.
Yes, we are.
Hopefully you remember this interview.
I will. I think I've got my alcoholism under control-ish. I'm not an alcoholic. I just really like bourbon.
That's what all alcoholics say. You got the
what
language.
Time is it, man? It's like, what, it's 4:46 p.m. I can have 6 bourbons if I want to.
It's absolutely, I mean, it's
I could have 10. I'm fine.
You can have whatever you want.
Yes, I can, and that's why I'm a sex worker.
Well, let's talk a little bit about those articles that you were mentioned in. So you were interviewed specifically because during COVID there were instances of strip clubs being shut down, and there have been multiple reasons why strip clubs were shut down in two different phases. So do you want to tell me a little bit about the articles and why you were solicited?
All right. So this issue has affected every single woman that I know in the industry. Whether it be women that work massage parlors, whether it be women that work in the strip clubs, and I'm sorry, let me correct myself, whether it be people that work in parlors, whether it be people that work in the strip clubs, whether it be people, you know, just the encompassing the entire demographic of it. And it really hurt us all. It was unjust and unfair to have all of those things shut down. And I don't know, man. I had actually come into contact with COVID a week before the club closures. So I was in quarantine when they closed down.
Were you just like in a risk area, or did you contract COVID and like go through the...
I did not have COVID, but because I had come in like first contact with someone who was diagnosed with COVID, like one of my girlfriends, we gave a hug to each other. You know, because of that,
You had to be in isolation.
I had to be in isolation. And I went and got tested, you know, the responsible thing, as everyone should do. You guys go get tested. But, yeah, it sucked. So I was even angrier.
So was this, are you talking about the initial time, the first time that lockdown happened and everything got closed down? Strip clubs were included like every other business. But then when businesses started opening back up, and the strip clubs as well, with all the precautionary measures and whatnot, there were a few instances that were highlighted in the media where one person at Brass Rail, for example, had COVID, a client, and then exposed, I don't know how many people to it. And then that was kind of blown up in the media. And some sex workers came forward to confront this notion that strip clubs are more dangerous than, say, your average restaurant, right, where the cases of exposure to COVID are much higher than they have been in strip clubs. But strip clubs were one of the first businesses to be shut down. And today, they're shut down and restaurants are still open. Mind you, that indoor dining has been phased out as well.
They shut us down unfairly. There was no actual reason. They said that the reasoning behind it was because the exposure rate was so much greater in the clubs than it would have been in anywhere else in Toronto, which is not true. There have been the same, if not more, exposures in restaurants and bars. And since the schools opened up, cases have been on the rise nonstop. You know, it's discriminatory. It's hurt all of our feelings. It made us all feel marginalized, put all of us in a position where now we just have to wait to see what happens next.
Well, why do you think that it's much easier for them to justify closing down strip clubs than it is restaurants?
Because I think a lot of the time we're a cash business, and maybe it doesn't support their economy as like legitimately as they would like to see. You know, the reason that bars and restaurants and a lot of places are still open is because they want to still be able to give people jobs, right, and keep the economy going and keep it from crashing. But why are sex workers any different than any other employee? Like, why is that a thing? Why are we getting the shit end of the stick? Like, we're not, in my opinion, we were operating cleaner than I've ever seen any strip club operate in my life. Are you kidding me? Like, I could eat food off the floor at a strip club, guys. It was nuts.
So I think that strip clubs and sex workers are considered more expendable in this sense because, like you mentioned, economically speaking, there's, first of all, not as many strip clubs, and they don't generate as much sort of economic benefit compared to the amounts of bars and restaurants where people do tend to go a lot. And furthermore, sex workers aren't monitored for their income in the same way. So basically, when it comes to taxation, it's another economic gray area. Some sex workers will pay taxes if they choose to, and some won't. And there's no way to really enforce that. So I guess there are these things. But at the same time, you're talking about a marginalized community of people who don't have the protective benefits like other legal employees in the economy who who are able to apply for EI, who are able to apply for all sorts of government benefits, who do have pension plans and who have all sorts of things set up to protect them, including labor laws. So because of that, sex workers are already expendable because they're easy to get rid of, they're easy to ignore, and nobody's going to fight for sex workers.
Oh, we're not easy to get rid of.
Oh, I'm not saying that they will, but but in the economic sense, it's easy to say, okay, shut down sex clubs because the backlash isn't going to be strong. The only people fighting for that are going to be sex workers and their allies, which aren't as many as the amount, the herds of people that are going to be complaining about, I can't go to a restaurant.
That's really annoying because I honestly think sex workers should be essential workers. Are you kidding me? Where are all these people going to go and get their things sorted without us? You know, like, what's going to happen without us? Would you prefer your partner or your man or whatever to go into an establishment that isn't monitored, that isn't constantly cleaned, where the dancers don't protect themselves, you know, where you could potentially be going somewhere else that isn't safe? I really feel like they thought they were doing something to help the community, but in reality, you're pushing all of these women out into different parts of the industry that A, they may not be as experienced in, so not going to be as safe for both the women and the people partaking.
So this makes me want to ask, what does the COVID safe strip club look like? Because you were saying it was fairly clean. What did the operation look like during COVID that was different from how it operated before?
You know how sometimes you walk into a bar and there's drinks left on the table? It wouldn't even be on the table for more than 5 seconds if it was empty. Immediately taken away, sanitized, even while people are sitting there. There was plexiglass up in between for barriers between people. It smelled like bleach and cleaner almost every single day when I walked in. Hand sanitizer in every single dance booth. Masks kept on. Things kept at a distance. You know, it was working. It was, if anything, safer than pre-pandemic because people have their masks on and people aren't asking to lick my body. You know, like there was one guy that tried to lick my nipple through his mask, and that was the weirdest. Like, I was.
Now with this in mind, considering everything that we've been talking about, I wonder what an optimally run sex club would look like. And I'm talking about one that's kind of centered around the needs of sex workers and their safety.
Well, it'd be nice if there were policies in place for, like, interpersonal problems for customers who steal or assault dancers. If there were contracts provided and updated every time the rules change, you know? No forced free dances, because there are some clubs that they'll put all the girls on stage, and this is just to get people into the club, right? They'll put on all the girls on stage, whatever, and then if a customer approaches you, you have to give them a free dance. That's not cool. That's me working with my body for the club for free. I don't want to do that.
I've not even heard of that.
It happens in some clubs. No policing of rates. I don't want the club to tell me what to charge, right? I understand the $20 a song, dance, whatever, right? Like, you go into the booth, you sit down, it's $20 a song, cool. If I choose to charge the client more because the experience wasn't that great for me, or because something happened between the client and myself, I should be able to do that. And I should not do that with the nervousness of thinking that I might get fired.
Okay.
And that's something that happens a lot. If the club will find out that you overcharged a client and you explain to the club why you overcharged them, they'll be like, no. And you will be forced to give some of the money, some if not all of the money back, and sometimes you lose your job.
So in a situation like this, are you talking about having a club where individual dancers set their own rates for private dances?
No. That's not what I'm talking about. I think the rates for private dances should be the same across the board.
Okay.
But I think once you get up there, if your client makes you feel a type of way, if there's anything else that's going on between you and the client, depending on what club you're at, you should be able to charge the rate that you want to charge.
So would this be just asking the client to sort of pay more because of the experience and then hoping that they would? Because in this sense, who's going to be able to enforce that? Even if you have management backing you up, if management were to be behind you for every one of those instances, I could foresee a situation where that would look like bullying somebody for money. And I'm not saying you personally, but given that a lot of strip clubs have been run by traditionally mobs in the past, right? If this were a policy where you say, I didn't like the experience, so I'm going to charge him more. And then this client says, well, I don't want to pay more. But now management...
You get them to prepay. You can tell within the first, 2 minutes of talking to a person whether they're going to be a piece of shit or not. And when you get up there, depending on what service you want to sell to the client, right?
Yeah.
You're able to negotiate.
Yeah.
And you're able to get money up front.
Right.
So you never do anything without getting money up front.
So in those instances, this is what you're talking about. You're talking about I'm talking to the client and we're setting up our own private negotiation. And if he chooses to give me more money, then management should allow me to take that money.
Exactly.
Versus the alternative, which is I didn't like the experience, therefore I want to charge him more and management should back me up.
It's not so much a management should back me up as once the transaction happens between client and dancer.
Yeah.
There shouldn't be a discrepancy with management suddenly interrogating the dancer
right. As
per what happened. Because what happened doesn't fucking matter, because this girl works at the club, or this person, this dancer works at the club, and you are there to protect them. And if what they say is a thing, then you should by all means listen to it, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm just trying to piece it together, because... In an instance where it's left up to individual dancers to negotiate, which already happens, first of all.
We
already know that it happens. Individual dancers will go upstairs with a client. They can negotiate all sorts of things from deals for the amount of songs, or sometimes extra favors. Sometimes full service sex work happens in a lot of strip clubs. And that is something that management sometimes knows about, and they just don't concern themselves with it. Some places have strict policies that say, no, we don't do that, and so on. But management should be able to enforce that a client pays at least what they owe you based off of the standard rate. So if they stayed up there for 3 songs, they got to pay their 3 songs. And anything else that's negotiated, they shouldn't penalize you, is what I'm hearing.
Exactly. I don't think employees in the strip club should get penalized for wanting to charge more for a service that they see as fit. I don't want the club to tell me what I charge for my body. It's my fucking body.
Right. And also, a lot of this is based off a tipping system. So if I had 3 dances with you and it was $60 and I enjoyed it and I'm like, here's a tip for you, then that's the same sort of thing. I mean, management wouldn't say anything about that.
Management wouldn't say anything about that. But the issue... comes up when you charge the client and they start to disagree. That's when the issue comes up. And when that happens, ideally, if they talk to the person that was dancing for said client and they understand the situation better, then yes, back them up and send the client on their way.
Okay. It would just be difficult in those instances for, I think, management to arbitrate between who's right and who's wrong in that interaction.
The dancer is right every time.
But
the dancer is right every time. No, absolutely not. In that environment, if it's a person that's naked dancing for another person, we are correct every single time. We are the ones that are putting ourselves in harm's way, at risk, doing this for another person in an environment where we would like to think that it's safe, but obviously everybody knows that it's not. So a lot of the times these things are done under the rug. But it would be really nice if, when these things happen, once they stop policing all the rates in the club, once they stop putting a maximum on what we can charge an hour, because within an hour a lot of things can happen. I feel a lot of clubs care more about the client than they do the dancer.
Right. And this is what I was getting at. I think this is why I think it would be a difficult thing to ask, because the client-centric focus happens in most industries. Now, I agree with you that you shouldn't be penalized or your job shouldn't be threatened for trying to negotiate some sort of like monetary transaction with your client based on your experience. But for the club to try to enforce it on your behalf without knowing what happened would put them in conflict with the client. So it's in the same way, if I'm working in
they
the
shouldn't give a shit about the client. They need to keep the girls safe.
I hear you.
That's but it. Like, that is it. We are in the club. Working... We have been unsafe the whole time. We're always unsafe. I step into a strip club. I say hi to my managers, whatever. Mm-hmm. Cool. I go downstairs. I get dressed. I try not to talk to any manager for the rest of the night. Anytime there's an issue that arises, I prefer to take a cut in the money that I had just earned than speak to management, because I know 100% of the time management will side with the client and I will likely get fired.
That's what I'm saying. That seems to be industry standard. I remember working in the service industry and it's the same thing, right? Like the client is going to pay for their meal or their drinks, whatever it is. And then anything negotiated outside of that in terms of your tips or what they're willing to offer is not something that management will ever back you up on. So if you say, you know, these people spent $500 and they left me nothing, right? Even though I gave them great service, management won't do anything about that. They'll just be like, well, that's the risk you take. And what I'm hearing is in your instance, if you try to make that complaint, it's not only that management won't back you up about getting that money that you asked for, but they'll actually threaten your job just for asking for that protection, mm-hmm. which is something I'm agreeing with you on. I don't see how management would be able to protect you further to ask for that extra money on your behalf, because the client's going to say, I don't owe you shit other than that $60 for the three songs.
But that's why you got paid up front.
Yeah.
Right? You always get paid up front.
But you were talking about
the client always tries to be sneaky with things. Mm. It's just a thing in strip clubs.
Yeah.
They want to get the most for the least.
Oh, I hear you.
There's seldom a client that comes in and is like, I love women. I'm here to pay you all. Who wants their rent paid? Like, it doesn't freaking happen like that. I wish Captain Save-A-Ho come into my life, but like, it's not. It's just, you go in, you think you're going to get fired almost every single fucking night you work there. You don't know what type of customer is going to come in. Sometimes it's dead, sometimes it's not. And you hope everything's okay with management. All the time.
Okay, so let's go back to this.
Every single time you want to make more money than what you are allowed to be making, you're taking a risk.
Mm-hmm. So I think the overarching thing that you're saying here is allow for some flexibility in your ability as an autonomous sex worker who's already not protected by the law and unable to seek sort of power and protection anywhere else, to have mm-hmm. a little bit of that security and protection from the people that are employing you, so that you can, first of all, go to work and feel safe, and when you're there, be able to negotiate some of the standards around your services mm-hmm. that won't penalize you and threaten your job. Mm-hmm. So then let's go back to this idea of this ideal sex club. Let's build it. What would management look like in a club like this? First of all, who should be managing this place, and how should they go about managing it?
Wow. A lot of the times from management, in passing, what I've heard is that they feel like they're babysitting, right? A lot of girls, a lot of dancers, we like to go into work, we like to get drunk, some women like to party, whatever. Sometimes, but that also happens when you have like a plethora of unseasoned dancers, right? The younger the dancers in the club, the more kind of, I wouldn't say unprofessionalism, but when someone's fresh in the industry, like a few months in versus someone that's seasoned,
they're bound to make rookie mistakes.
Exactly. An ideal owner for a strip club would be a former sex worker, 100%, or someone that's still in the industry. Like if a stripper were to open, actually, you know what? I worked at one in Hawaii. Mm. It's called Ballerinas. And it was probably, hands down, the best, most supportive club I've ever worked at in my life. It's run by a woman who's a dancer still to this date. like still dances in the club that she owns. She's 29. And yeah, built it from the ground up and just fucking did it on all on her money. And it's one of the best clubs in Honolulu.
Wow.
It's amazing.
So you've worked all over the place.
Yes, I have.
And this is why I wanted to ask you these questions about the ideal strip club, because I imagine your diverse experience working throughout probably North America, mm-hmm. right? You've gone throughout Canada and the US. First of all, is there a huge difference between strip clubs in Canada versus the US?
Yeah. I would really, really like it if Canada had a tipping culture, like a heavy tipping culture like they do in the States.
So in the States, not only do you get your $20 a song, but then you get tipped as a customary practice?
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's all about the singles. And it feels really nice when you're on stage and someone's like, wow, you're so beautiful. You're dancing so well. And then dumps $50 in ones on you. Feels really nice. And of course, you go home, you take your showers with Dettol, but whatever.
Like, sounds like we need $1 bills in Canada.
Yeah, it'd be nice if we have $1 bills. Out in the prairies, they do like the toonie toss or the loonie toss where you like...
Oh, Lord.
you get one of your promo posters and you kind of make a cone out of it.
Oh, okay, okay.
Get the guys to throw a bunch of loonies into your promo cone. It's real dumb, but I mean, it works. Oh, and right. Then you get to swing a magnet around on a rope to pick up your money. I'm not kidding.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you've really worked everywhere.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so a tipping culture, like in the States?
The tipping culture in the States is really great. I don't know if anyone's been up on Cardi B's birthday shows that have been online on her feed lately on Instagram, but she is all about the ones and all about giving them to strippers, and she does it anytime she has any excuse to, and it makes me so happy. But yeah, I'm talking about like maybe like an inch thick layer of singles just all over the floor, everywhere. Why not? Why not in Canada? That could be so nice.
I mean, I've seen this sort of done in a way with burlesque dancers. So I've been to a burlesque show in Toronto where you could buy stripper bucks. So you basically go up to the front, you exchange real money for, you know, this fake paper that looks like American dollar bills.
Yeah.
And you could get singles. So in that sense, you could just shower the performers with those singles. And that way, it actually gets a lot more people to buy that kind of money and to do the performative act of throwing a bunch of singles on stage.
Yeah, and it makes people want to interact more, right? That's why that is a thing in the States. And that's why some places in Canada sell singles, or they'll have like American dance club days. Where they can throw singles.
Yeah, because like throwing 1-5 looks cheap, but throwing 5-1s looks all right.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And you're more encouraged to do it.
Yeah, it makes a huge difference. makes the dancer feel good.
And it makes people on a budget feel like they're more able to participate in an economy where, you know, the more money you have, obviously the more attention you're going to get and the more you're able to afford. So from your experience being all over the States and Canada, what are some other differences, and maybe what were some of your favorite and least favorite experiences?
Wow. Least favorite was definitely this club that I worked at in Abbotsford.
Where the hell is that?
It's right outside of Vancouver. And I got bed bugs there.
Wow.
And that is all. I left.
You got bed bugs in the strip club?
Yep. Yeah, that was a long time ago. I will never go back. The club does not exist anymore.
For reasons.
Yep.
And then what was some of your favorite experiences?
Oh, definitely New Orleans. Yeah. By all means. When I first started dancing, that was like the craziest time of my life. I wish for the time being, like while I was down there, I could have like made moves to get my citizenship. But now I'm so grateful I'm not an American. Yeah, it was. I remember one night I made $3,600 in under 4 hours. And I could have made more if I didn't fall asleep eating Funyuns on the client's lap. Don't drink the champagne when you're in a champagne room. That's like the first rule.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it was nuts. I had this like multi-millionaire that just sold his medical company and was like obsessed with me and just wanted to hang out, and I fell asleep. Yeah. Fuck that up. Funions. I fucked that up.
Now
that
that's
was
a sugar
crazy
daddy.
Time. Well, no, it was in the club.
Yeah.
It was in the strip club in New Orleans. It was nuts. They have like a whole other floor that you can rent for like, it's like $6,000 an hour or something fucking stupid. Yeah.
So then your ideal strip club would be something like the Honolulu Club. It's owned by somebody who's had has
Diamond,
experience.
Diamond Thomas is her name.
Diamond Thomas.
Yeah. I think she has, that might be the short form of her name.
Yeah.
I believe she has like a more, like a...
Formal name.
Her formal name is very, it's Hawaiian. It's something I cannot, I can't, I don't know how to articulate.
I hear you.
Her name, but her baby's name is Paige and her mama's name is Diamond, and they're adorable. Diamond is, she has the girls in the club, they run it like a family. Everyone takes care of each other. Everyone is always up on each other's business in the way that like they're supporting one another, and I think that's really, really cool. There's no drama in the club. It's always been a really positive experience every time I go there. Anytime there's any issue with anything, you talk to the owner right away because she's very involved with all of her employees. And yeah, she'll put you on, which is good.
Anything else that you would add to this ideal strip club?
No fines.
Fines are for what usually?
Leaving early.
Mm.
Or like if you are late for a schedule shift, which you get paid in cash for and they don't give you a receipt for. If you're late for a schedule shift, sometimes they'll fine you.
Well, then the last thing that I like to ask on this show is if you have a fun, wild, outrageous, or sexy story to end off on a light note. Anything.
I peed on a guy in a tub one time in Kelowna for not enough money, but I did it because I wanted to. I like made him lay in the bathtub and I pissed all over him, and then he told me that my pee smells like chicken soup, and then I went to the doctor because I don't think that's what pee should smell like.
Were you okay?
I was fine. This is just, I don't know, dude's on drugs. I guess his nose wasn't working that well.
Did he pay you to pee on him?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course.
Was this part of your stripping experience?
Yeah, I went and met up with them after I worked a club in Kelowna.
All right.
Yeah.
Have a lot of people asked you to pee on them?
Yes.
Do you know how many?
Six.
Six.
Six people.
On them, in their mouths, anywhere else?
One guy was all over him while he was fully clothed in the tub, like fully clothed. There was another guy that like just wanted me to pee in his mouth, also in the tub. There's another guy who just happened in bed, but they also wanted it. And I sold a few pee videos. Yeah, that was cool.
Chicken soup for the soul.
Chicken soup for the perv.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, before I let you go then, where do you want people to find you?
Oh, I've got lots of accounts. Y'all can find me at as above so be ho on Instagram. That's as above ABOVE so SOBBE ho. If you don't know how to spell the last one, just don't even add me. Yeah, you'll find all my other links on there. There's another account, Pizza Slut. See you there.
All right. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, dude. It was a pleasure. Pleasure being here. And thank you for the many, many bourbons.
Cheers.
Hey, guys. You're listening to Intellectual Erection, a place where we talk about the naughty to stimulate your thinking.